So I think that despite what many people are saying, oh, we're not gonna, like somebody wrote somewhere, we're not gonna achieve the goals of 2080 something. I'm like, is this person crazy? Why would you even say that? 2080 something, we'll be dead. We'll be told,
Yeah,
right? So it's not that we're not gonna achieve the goals by 2030. We have to ask a different question. How can we ensure that the delay in achieving the goals is not more than 5 years, right? And therefore, it means that we have to change the systems. You have to have more action-oriented labs, more collaborators, and that's why my book calls for the establishment of global collaboratories that can test out new ways of designing systems, new ways of sharing information, so we can get to better globally viable solutions faster.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we talk with industry leaders, climate champions, and sustainability professionals who are making an impact in their businesses today. Each leader is solving complex challenges and providing solutions within their respective areas of expertise. And here's our host, Sean Grady.
Hello, ET Nation. I'm excited to announce that I've updated my website that provides listeners more access to episode content and information about the podcast. Please take a moment and visit the website and sign up for email notifications and blog postings. Also, check out our sponsors page to see who supports the show. We can't thank these industry leaders enough. Finally, I would really appreciate if you would take a moment and post a review and rate the podcast episodes either from my website or from within your podcast app. This helps the podcast get more exposure on Apple Podcasts and other podcast networks. Also, please send me comments and recommendations on topics that you want to hear about. I hope you enjoy the new website, so check it out at www.seankgrady.com.
Well, welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Grady, and today's guest is Dr. Claire Nelson. She's the author of her new book called Smart Futures for a Flourishing World, a Paradigm Shift for Achieving Global Sustainability. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean Grady.
Yeah, I'm excited. So, Claire, you've got a you've been in you've been in the business doing sustainability for quite a while. Let's talk a little bit about your journey so far, and then we'll dive into this book. Give us a little background about your experience and what you've been doing this, you know, in your career.
When I think back on my career, I would say probably my first foray into sustainability, we didn't call it that back then, was when I was doing my master's thesis in energy modeling. It was the era of the great energy crisis. Remember back then?
Yeah, back in
78. Exactly.
Yeah.
I was at Purdue doing industrial engineering, and I decided to do an energy model, you know, modeling and, you know, simulation modeling was hot. It was just the thing of the time.
Yeah.
So I decided to do, what was it? A multi-objective goal programming model of to do energy planning. And I did a case study of Jamaica. And I think my second big foray into it was when I started working. I was doing a doctorate at the time, and I decided to look at the question of technology assessment because I was concerned how many white elephants were being invested in developing countries. Mm. And at the time, the World Bank and organizations of such had not yet put in place environmental safeguards. So my dissertation research was called a systems approach to whole systems technology assessment. And I created like a framework for looking at impact of a technology on the environment, social impact, life cycle impact, intellectual property impact, a whole lot of impact, which I thought from an engineering perspective would make less white elephants come out of the, you know, out of our investments in countries of, what is, hospitals, schools, roads, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I like to think that I was a pioneer.
I'd say you were a pioneer. You were like the OG of sustainability back in the day, right?
Back
come
in
on.
The day.
Come on, so yeah.
I started using the phrase, sustainability engineer probably around 10, 11 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Because although I have an industrial engineering degree, I've never really worked in a regular manufacturing industry. I've always worked in economic development planning.
Right.
And I used those skill sets to treat whatever challenge I was looking at it from a whole systems framework of design. So I would think that I hope that when I've looked at the problems I've tried to design for, I hope that I've looked at sustainability using the lens of my doctorate as how is this going to impact on the social, environmental, and political space in which this new technology or project, program, plan, whatever is being embedded.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's really good. Well, okay, so tell us a little bit about the book that you wrote and, you know, why did you write it? And then more importantly, I mean, you've used some creative storytelling to get your message across to the reader a little bit. So let's talk about these three futures that you weave into the conversation. So for the listeners.
Well, help me remember. So the first thing is, why did I write the book? Well, I wrote the book because I kind of self-appointed myself as a SDG evangelist. Mm-hmm. I was there when the Millennium Development Goals was founded. I was still working in the belly of the beast in Washington, so to speak. And I was very annoyed because I thought they were not successful. They were successful in terms of it did allow the agencies to at least have a shared goal. So that was a major success. I wouldn't say it was. That was a big shift from how we worked before, this kind of haphazard, who does what, and then each country does something. So you weren't seeing sort of a cohesive move forward towards the future. So when SDGs were thought about long before they were formed, I started really thinking about what would we do differently. And by this time, I had developed an interest in foresight, strategic foresight,
tool
for development planning.
Right.
My argument for that was that we were doing a lot of investments based on planning on the past and extrapolating the past into the future, which mm-hmm. when you think about it, especially because we're now doing policy-based lending, so you're doing an environmental sector loan or education sector loan or a healthcare sector loan, you can't just simply say, well, we had 55 patients last year, we're going to have 55 patients plus 10% because the population is growing by 10%. That's not how it works in terms of reality. Mm-hmm. Of course, I might add, when I started to try to do foresight in development at my institution, most people look at me as if I had grown two horns.
You're like, what planet are you from, Claire? Although I'm sure you'd be like best buddies with Bart Eads right now, probably, right?
I was not exactly a favorite person. I must say, however, that my manager did give me some leeway. But the fun about it for me was when I brought in some what I call well-established futurists to talk about, you know, how they could use foresight in their work. And he said, man, just said, well, let's see if they bite, because he really liked the idea, but he didn't want to impose it on them.
Right.
I must say he was extremely bright guy, he was. And so most of them said, even those who were doing education sector lending was like, oh, I don't see the value of this for what we're doing. Or one said, we don't have a mandate. I'm like, okay, I know it's only because it's I who am saying it, why you're not listening, but that's okay. I got what I wanted out of it, which is at least to get the idea on the table in the air. So mm-hmm. I find it fascinating now that the UNDP is all about telling countries they must do strategic foresight. I'm like, I said this back in the day, and nobody listened.
Again, the original.
So that's why I decided to write this book, because I do think the SDGs has to go beyond even, I mean, they're doing a much better job than the MDGs in terms of trying to popularize it, trying to include more mm-hmm. people. But I think it's still much the space of the policy wants, if you will, the development wants. And so when I speak to my friends, family members who have no interest in it, they're like, what do you do? What is that? You know what I mean? So the first thing, even in creating the name of the title, it was supposed to be Sustainable Development Goals. And I did a poll of some of my friends and I said, what is that? So I'm like, okay, sustainability, they understood without knowing the goals. So let me just say sustainability in the title so that mm-hmm. we don't only focus on trying to reach the already converted to thinking about the goals, but that we can convert some people who are not necessarily interested in the UN numbers, but they are interested in being a part of the social movement because they've been awoken to the reality that we can't continue as we have been.
That's true. You're absolutely right. I mean, with COVID happening and the world shutting down and the realization that, you know, climate change is a real situation now, more so evident than ever. It's in the top of mind of most social, people in the world today. So,
but those who are conscious, I should say, those who are not consciously aware, maybe subconsciously aware, depending on where they sit on the poverty scale.
Uh-huh.
So that if you're extreme poor and you're constantly having to, replant or losing your crops, you may not have the sophisticated language for it, but you certainly know that, your farm isn't doing as well as it is, or your fish aren't doing as well as it is. So you're aware that something is happening that's making it harder for you to make up your living at the margins, on the margins.
Well, okay. So, you've had that background with, wanting to really kind of be evangelist of, sustainability and SDGs and things like that. So talk about this idea of writing the book and weaving these stories to bring out the message.
So what happened was when I got the call from Tim Ward, who is the publisher of the series Resetting Our Futures, he said, somebody told me you may have a book in you. I'm like, well, I don't know about that. He says, really? I said, what do you do? I told him what I was doing. He said, it sounds like a book to me because I've been talking about the smart futures for some time. Why? Because I just got so irritated about all this hoopla about, we're going to have smart autonomous cars and we're going to have smart refrigerators going to tell you when you need milk. You're going to have smart houses. I'm like, wait a minute. What's going to left for us to do? We're the only dummies try to outsource all of what we do to machines so we can sit around and do nothing, right? And then we talk about smart cities and I'm like, really? The smart city is really about, we're going to have electric lights and we're going to have to collect better taxis and collect, make sure you can get, don't be speeding if you can't spot the camera. You're going to get tickets in the mail you didn't know you were. So I was kind of mad and I do my best thinking if I'm irritated, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So I was like, we're the only idiots that talk about smart everything and where is that even about? We need to talk about smart futures. And that slogan popped in my head. So when Tim Ward said, you have a book in you, I said, well, what do you, I said, I really want us to become smarter about the future. I want more people. I want 11% of people in the world, especially those who have a smartphone, to who are in leadership at some level of life or another, whether it's political leadership, managerial leadership, academic leadership, NGO leadership, church leadership, leadership of your home, you have a smartphone, then you're more than likely connected to the world in some way. And you're more than likely recognize that we are together one whole.
More connected than you believe because, the world's getting a lot smaller with technology.
Exactly. So I said, if I can get 11% of these people to always ask some smart questions when they're designing a product or a policy or interrogating a rule or, they're protesting something, but they don't have the language for it. If I can get them to ask five smart questions, we can design our way out of the sinking hole that we have kind of slipped into. Because we're kind of in a sinking hole trying to scramble out, right?
Uh-huh.
And so many times you have a technical design solution, but the political will and the social space isn't there for that technical solution to emerge, to be invested in, and then to flourish. And so you need more people consciously able to speak the same language, and hence the need for this framework, the Smart Futures framework, as well as the idea that doing it in such a way that we bring the stakeholders together, then you need a narrative.
That's where the little future storytelling comes in, because you're trying to work on the emotional heartstrings of the reader in a way that they understand the analogy through these stories.
Exactly. Not only that, if I'm saying that we do better design around water resources, if in the meeting you don't just have the experts on hydrology and sanitation and engineering, but you actually have, you know, the people who are using water for manufacturing, or a couple of people who represent, you know, condominiums, or a couple of people who represent academia, you have a couple of people who represent people who, you know, can barely pay a water bill. If you have a couple of people on the table, you may have a better overall design to achieving the SDG on water for whatever country or city or town or county you're doing this research or this proposal or this planning for. Mm-hmm. But typically what happens, you will have an engineer that only knows how to speak to engineers. Or you have an economist who only knows how to speak to economists, and therefore never the twain shall meet. Uh-huh. If we want to achieve a future and design the most efficient way, it's best to design together. It might take a little more time on the front end, but you save time on the back end, right? So mm-hmm. design together means that when you get people into the room and you're using a foresight approach, you're starting with some anticipatory stories, some anticipated narratives that elicit what people want, and trying to find a shared language, a common language for this vision that the solution you're trying to design is going to create. What does the world look like? What does your town look like? What does your community look like if you have achieved success? And a story is the best form of accomplishing that.
And that's part of that strategic foresight, you know, exercise too, creating that, you know, that what if, or that, you know, what desired outcome do I want to achieve? Right. Like you mentioned. So, yeah, that's part of it. And using that stories to get you there. That's great. I love that.
This episode is sponsored by Regenesis. Have you noticed that the use of traditional methods to remediate PFAS contamination in groundwater are proving difficult for many who are struggling to manage long-term PFAS exposure? Pump-and-treat systems using activated carbon filters are expensive and difficult to treat wide areas of PFAS contamination. But now, there's a proven alternative to pump-and-treat systems that eliminates PFAS risk for decades. Regenesis has developed PlumeStop, an in-situ remediation technology that solves PFAS remediation challenges in groundwater. Applied under low-pressure injection, PlumeStop's colloidal-activated carbon quickly and safely addresses PFAS without the expense and maintenance costs incurred with pump-and-treat systems. To learn more about PlumeStop and the science behind Regenesis' proprietary organic polymer dispersion chemistry, go to www.pfostreatment.org. That's www.pfostreatment.org.
Well, okay, so what are the challenges we are faced with now, and how, you know, how did we get here?
Well, when you think, so it was funny because I thought nobody's going to think these five questions can solve anything, because they don't always think it has to be hard, right? it's complex, but it doesn't have to be hard. It's two different things. It's complex because everything is everything, as the Rastafarian used to say in Jamaica. It's all connected, but we have been taught and we have been trained in disciplines that don't always speak to each other. So even within the engineering discipline, we don't have a common language for deciding what the sustainability literacy looks like. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to create a global working group to do just that, so that we can have, you know, chemical engineers saying for us it has to have these five things, for civil it has to have these five things. Okay, so if you're a freshman doing engineering, right, what are you going to understand about sustainability before you go into your particular
profession?
And so this idea of trying to cultivate a language because of these challenges is really critical to the construct that drove me. So I thought about things like, okay, why do we make certain decisions? World economists normally say this is the way it has to be. It's very rare that a county, a government, a country says, okay, engineers, design what you want and we'll build it. No, the economists typically say, well, we have a budget of $5 million. Go and design a road that matches that. And if you come back with something that's more than that, they're going to cut it. And even if you try to change it, they don't always see why that difference in the long run is going to save, you know, again, time and money. So there's the challenge. Mm-hmm. of the metrics. We don't have metrics that really measure what matters. Mm-hmm. What brought us here also, from my perspective, in a bigger issue of the environmental thing we're talking about, is my pet peeve about this construct that we sort of own the nature. We own nature. And so we can quantify it. We can chop off mountains. We can dig up hills. And so we have just laid waste to bauxite and coal and iron and all these things, which I'm not going to complain about because clearly we needed the things that we're doing. But we have done so in a way that did not really measure also the damage correctly.
Yeah, the impact, right?
Right. So we really have favored misuse or ill use of our resources. And this is why we're at this space. So I begin with saying, okay, our Judeo-Christian based capitalist monetary system globally, because that's what's driving the world, right, has got to do like a personality check, right? I preached that one Sunday in church and people were like, I don't know if they were happy or not, because they couldn't tell if they were really getting it. I wanted to test it out on a friendly audience. So I did it in my home church. My goal is to get many churches to do this gospel about declare about environmental covenant. What kind of covenant do we need, first of all, as spiritual beings having a material existence? What kind of covenant do we need as social beings, understanding that we can't, it's no longer cute to think about exporting waste to some poor country that, you know, can afford a way so we can live in clean, pristine nations. That's not cool anymore, because guess what? The waste in that country goes to the sea, and then the sea comes right back to us anyway. So
it's everything is everything right there, right?
Everything is everything. Right? And then we have all these other challenges around natural resources. Take, for example, the coltan that's in our phone. I mean, the places where coltan is mined, I mean, they're environmental disasters, right? Mm-hmm. And so those poor people in, you know, Congo or wherever other poor countries these things are, they don't have any power to demand stuff of their government, you know. So how do we who use the phones put in place some support for these fledgling environmental movements in these countries to have a little bit of comfort so they can have support when they try to show backbone before they're invariably killed by somebody or some new war is started, which gets rid of these people who are trying to create the issue. Uh-huh. And so there are so many ways in which I think the challenges around natural resource use or ill use, climate change enablers, quote unquote, so people who refuse to see that, listen, just it's not that hard if you're funded to find a carbon capture system, as opposed to funding, my pet peeve, and I'm sure they're going to probably hear this interview, my pet peeve is an idea to move green sand from Hawaii to the Caribbean to test if green sand can absorb more carbon than white sand. And I have a fundamental problem with geoengineering, for example, because typically in the decision making, there's nobody from the community that's at the design table. They're normally, right, brought on after design is done to say, well, you were going to do this design in your test, this pilot in your area, and we want you to kind of observe and see what happens.
Yeah.
I don't like that. So we need to have a different conversation around geoengineering on the earth, and as we move into space, certainly dampening down these ideas like, oh, let's just, you know, use nuclear stuff to kind of terraform Mars so we can have a place for humans to live because we're outgrowing the earth. Are we really outgrowing the earth if we were to change our metrics to be more morally meaningful? Are we really outgrowing the earth if we were to change the way we grow food, the way we distribute food, the way we save food from being wasted, the way we treat our soils, the way we treat our fertilizer systems and all the other systems we have? Have we really outgrown the earth, especially given that the birth rate in many countries is declining?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And once we finish creating all these robots to replace us, this is what I don't really understand.
The smart, right? Smart people.
What are we going to do? My mother used to tell me, you never find works for idle hands. Idle humans is not a good idea. We have to have things to do.
Yeah.
because not everybody is born with a natural tendency to have a poet waiting for the opportunity to stay at home and write poetry or write music or craft the most delightful knitted kaftans, right?
Yeah.
There's some people who really find purpose, whose soul blooms in the society in which they work, and they find identity and comfort and community in that. So before we go off and talk about, oh, people were released to do what there was this really meaningful work, but we say that to kind of comfort ourselves, but there's no plan, no plan.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so what do you think is driving this whole change to create a more sustainable future now that, you know, we've woken up in society? What's really behind it? Is it just the climate change, you know,
No, I think a few issue? of us, by a few of us, I mean, maybe there's about 15 million of us or so in the world who kind of realize whether or not we are environmentalists or economists or teachers from different walks of life. We realize that this is not sustainable. It's not going to work. I can see my grandchildren having a hard time with water. I can see how they're not going to have a good life because, you know, it's just the society. Certain kind of social capital and social cohesion is being destroyed. Look at what's happening in America right now. It's like, where's civility and politics? Yeah. Out the window. I mean, so here it is, we thought.
It's crazy.
At the end of the Cold War, we also have a Cold War in America. In America, we have a Cold War. So how do people of different opinions find room for a seat at the table to share a coffee and agree to hear each other out, agree to hear where we're coming from? I have to say, as somebody who did not consider myself an environmentalist, certainly in my 30s, I must have become a tree hugger recently because all of a sudden, I think one day I was reading about the whales being beached, and I was just weeping inconsolably. It was just the whale. Mind you, I've never seen a whale in real life, right? Just the thought of this majestic animal being beached.
Right. Affected because they're being affected by climate change, right?
Not this climate change. They're also being affected by underwater naval nuclear bombs.
Oh, well, yeah, there's that. And then also just over-harvesting the fish in the sea, right? And just causing damage there too, right?
A lot of things are affecting. So I found that I was so pained by that, I started paying attention to the sea. I'm from Ireland, I'm from Jamaica. And I realized that, my God, most Jamaicans don't care about the sea, and the sea could die one day because we already have coral bleaching and those things. So that's kind of how I became an environmentalist, quote unquote, over time, even though I wouldn't consider myself a practicing one. But I am an advocate for us really thinking about what we're doing to the earth. And I love your title, this regenesis, if you will, of us as now co-creators, now that we can clone sheep and, you know, splice the gene to create new species. We have to see ourselves in a true sense as being stewards.
Right.
Stewards of the earth, caretakers.
Yeah.
Not that we have done in the past where we take, but we don't care, right?
Right.
But caretakers, where we take care of the bounty that is in the earth that's available for us.
Well, and so that's how the, you know, the 17 sustainable development goals are being brought in. There's 169 targets that are, you know, they're supposed to be good, you know, measures, indicators of, you know, measuring the progress. And that's a lot of tracking of various things to, you know, monitor the progress. But, you know, we're trying to do that to meet these climate change temperature reductions to become more sustainable. I mean, how are we going to implement all these and do that?
Well, again, unfortunately, even though it's nice in theory and for people who are the ones, it's not really accessible to the average person, right? And not many cities have been able to bring it down to the local level, which you really need to do. We need to have like dashboards that are understandable. And this is why my framework, the S stands for sustainable systems, the M stands for meaningful metrics. A metric of 20% reduction in energy, so on, so it's not meaningful to the average person on the street. Okay, we don't care. We just want cheap gas to move our car. I say this as somebody who still drives a gas girlfriend car, even though I think about buying an electric car, because I'm thinking, well, my brother-in-law don't know how to fix an electric car. So if I buy a car, I'm going to spend more money taking to the mechanic because he doesn't know how to fix it. Okay. I'm just being honest, okay?
Yeah, right.
No, I do not drive an electric car. I have looked at what's happening in India. India's invested in trying to do solar energy charge cars. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait for this to hit the market. And I said, am I going to buy one? That's the question.
Well, I think we'll get there as the market kind of, you know, makes it affordable too, right? You know, there is a bit of the capitalistic sort of market trend, you know, market, pressures to move this way. And I think we're seeing a lot of companies in, you know, that are operating now are really pushing for these zero net carbon emissions, these green, sustainable, more practices. Some of the oil and gas companies are now becoming more energy companies, and they're looking at alternative ways to generate that energy, like through renewable natural gas or, you know, solar instead of the petroleum process that emits, you know, lots of carbon emissions. So I think there is a big shift in society. And over time, we're going to get there where I think electric cars and things are just the common way of purchasing products for vehicles. But there's also, there is a little bit of some regulatory pressure, policy pressure that's going to help expedite that, if some of these policymakers have their way with it. But I really feel like the market naturally will probably get there sooner rather than later.
Well, the question is, it really does need to get there sooner rather than later, because for islands and coastal zone communities, which are going to bear the brunt of the sea level rise, I think some of the models are suggesting that by 2035, some people are going to have to start moving. Has anybody talked about where those people are going to move to? Are their communities welcoming these people? Are playing out a pilot to see what it would look like, or a simulation, or a game?
If it's in the U.S., they better get their immigration policies fixed by then. I mean, they got 20 to 15 years to figure it out.
But you know what? I would say that the American Islands have now formed an organization. It's called Climate Strong Islands, and they're come on board, and they're creating partnerships with other islands around the world.
Great.
Hawaii is very much a leader in this space. Hawaii has a dashboard system that is really, I would say, enviable. I'm trying to figure out how to bring it something like that to Maryland, where I live. Coming up with some kind of, well, how would I get them to do it, And then clearly, as someone who's folks in the Caribbean region, I also want to see the Caribbean look at what Hawaii is doing to make the dashboard of data collection more accessible to leaders which are not necessarily involved in this big national planning. So in Hawaii, business leaders, community leaders are very much a part of the process. And so they're moving more rapidly towards this emissions cut down in terms of cars, because the policies are easier to move, it's easier to get people to vote, because people understand what it is we're trying to do. So I think we have to certainly work harder at doing this transdisciplinary community building, so that we can get the tipping point number of people who can vote in the kind of policies and policymakers that are critical for us to have sustainable future. That to me is one of the critical things we have to do.
If you're listening to this podcast, I'll bet you may be thinking, how can I level up and advance my career? If you want to get that promotion, increase your regulatory knowledge, gain professional recognition, and earn more money, then it's time to obtain an industry credential from the Institute of Hazardous Material Management. The IHMM offers 8 credentials that are ANSI approved for students, experienced, skilled employees without a degree, and for the degreed professional looking to set themselves apart from the pack. Their credentials focus on 3 main areas: Certified Hazardous Material Manager, the CHMM, the Certified Dangerous Goods Professional, the CDGP, and the Certified Safety and Health Manager, the CSHM. If you become an IHMM credential professional, then you will be in the top 1% of your profession and your credential will have a global reach. Check out their programs they offer at www.ihmm.org. That's www.ihmm.org. What are you waiting for? Get started today.
You know, we've got the 17 sustainability goals. You know, it is a bit of still kind of new terminology for most people in society. They're not really up to speed. If you're in the environmental business, you're very aware of it. Most companies are starting to become lots more familiar with them, especially if they're global national companies where they're in other countries. But, you know, how has the COVID-demic, as you say in your book, affected the implementation of SDGs?
Oh my God, I feel so distressed. Well, in some ways, well, it certainly has enabled more rapid uptake of a digital mindset, which is good, because some countries were saying, oh, we cannot do this and we cannot do that, but they were forced to do that. So that is a good thing. Many developing countries were forced to think about how are we going to teach students if they can't go to school? It's true that some children couldn't make it to school because they just live outside of the, you know, the access of access to internet, right? Uh-huh. Internet is not affordable universally. But for those students who lived in urban areas, some governments actually, you know, created mobile systems so that the kids could go to one area and sit with their parents' phone most times, not no laptop. And some countries were able to get funding to buy laptops for their students. And of course, many people in the diaspora, African diaspora, Caribbean diaspora, were engaged in doing fundraising to send laptops home to their primary school or laptops home to their high school so that the kids would not be left behind. So I think that's one positive outcome I want to flag. However, because we have to go back to the one-time non-reusable stuff, we have a whole bunch of plastic.
we do. That's a big problem.
And unfortunately, many of the plastic is not being done with biodegradable plastic because the biodegradable plastic is still fairly new and they were not set up for rapid like changeover. So what I do hope to see is the biodegradable plastic people trying to find a way to scale up what they're doing so we can move a lot of these masks and other systems over to biodegradable systems, given the major advances that have happened in nanotechnology and materials engineering, making them still able to withstand, bacteria or virus or whatever, but at the same time being biodegradable. And I'm sure some very clever people right now are working on those seven-syllable methyl cellulose, whatever system. I love right. those, you know, with the seven-sided figures and then all the carbon molecules going off of that. I did pass chemistry, but I never did understand it half of the time. I'm a physics person myself. But the point is, the material science people are working hard, I think, to do something about it. So I think that despite what many people are saying, somebody wrote somewhere, we're not going to achieve the goals till 2080 something. I'm like, is this person crazy? Why would you even say that? 2080 something, we'll be dead. We'll be told.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not that we're not going to achieve the goals by 2030. We have to ask a different question. How can we ensure that the delay in achieving the goals is not more than 5 years, right? And therefore, it means that we have to change the systems. You have to have more action-oriented labs, more collaborators. And that's why my book calls for the establishment of global collaboratories that can test out new ways of designing systems, new ways of sharing information, so we can get to better globally viable solutions faster.
Well, so who are some of the voices driving, you know, society to these sustainable changes to achieve these smart future? Like, you know, in the book you mentioned there's a bunch of tribes, you know, that are kind of, you know, leading or influencing, you know, the narrative here. So talk about that a bit if you could.
Right. So I decided to use the term tribes because of how separate we tend to be. So when you think of yourself as a person, the average person probably belongs to maybe 4 or 5 tribes, right? Because there's a tribe of your family. There's a tribe sometimes of your faith community, if you are a member of a faith community. There's a tribe of the college you went to, right? And then your loyalty, right? Definitely sports fans are like tribes. They will like slaughter each other over one goal, right? Then we have tribes in terms of the sector. So you have the merchant tribe, which are people who are in the business of making money, and that's their primary goal. You have what I call the caretaker tribe, which are the NGO community, civil society, that try to kind of want to do good for most people, right? Then you have the education tribe. I call those the mentors that are trying to educate and support the next generation of people and leaders. And we have the elected officials or the leader tribe, which elected officials whose job it is supposedly to take care of government and governance. And so each of them have a different way of seeing the world, and unfortunately most times they don't always speak to each other. However, I have to say, with the SDGs, I have seen where many big companies, global companies, have signed the social compact, right, for the SDGs.
Yep.
We see where many universities around the world, especially the bigger ones, have signed on to different charters or principles of practice that they hope to imbue on their campuses so that they can also drive sustainability in their campuses and impact on the surrounding. Because some universities, depending on how large they are, actually drive the economy of a town. So they really do have influence over, you know, social change. And so that's very exciting. So between academia, private sector, and civil society, all of which I'm kind of calling the plural sector to some extent, I think. Oh, and of course, media. How could I forget media? No, media is kind of iffy, butty. I don't know if media has actually signed on in any serious way to support the goals. I don't think so. I think there's a couple people, but I put them in there because I think one of the things I would like to see happen, I would like to see the entertainment community in particular do a better job of, you know, funding films and entertaining movies and games that truly entertain while educating us about how can we solve these problems. I mean, gamification is hot, right? You know that. But it's still mostly, you know, some shoot-up, or if it's a gamification, it's boring, and it's obviously you're trying to teach us something, but we don't really want to learn. So the average person don't really want to learn. I mean, even me, I read trash. When I'm not reading a textbook, I don't want to read any intelligent book, okay? I want to read, like, you know, How to Create Romance.
You want the, you know, the magazine or, you know, some other something quick and easy. You don't have to, you know, spend too much time focusing on it.
So when I'm reading about gamification, which I try to read about, I try to read something that is a fun read and not an academic read, right?
Yeah, right. That's
what I learn faster. So I think if we're doing the job of entertaining people while we're sneaking some knowledge, I like stories. I think stories can be made to be educational, but still entertain people and let them laugh or cry or feel something. That's very important.
Yeah. So that's part of that storytelling that comes through in the book, with your kind of, you know, you're sneaking it in that way, which is good. I like your analogy there. That was kind of sly right there. That was nice. How is in your book, you talk about the weird society, you know, talk about how they're standing in the way of making changes needed to achieve sustainable goals.
Well, the weird societies, I came upon this word, I think it was coined by, I don't know, some economists usually, but it's Western, educated, industrialized, rich, developed countries, right?
Mm-hmm. And democratic.
They have a lifestyle to which they have become accustomed, right? Now, so let's say that's Europe, Canada, the US, and maybe Australia, Japan, Korea, maybe a few others, right? But by and large, these are they. And they have a lifestyle to which they have become accustomed. And they're not going to give it up. I think the US is probably the worst, because our social cohesion is not as developed as the older nations, right? I mean, America's relatively young at, what, is it 400 years or something? So when you look at Greece, which is like thousands of years old, or Turkey, and, you know, these societies have been around ever since, you know, you can see all the ruins, right? They're mm-hmm. of human society. So they're continuous societies almost. They have a more social capital sometimes, not all the time, because we still have wars, etc. over there. But in things like, I think climate change and flooding affects them, I think there's more agreement as to what should happen. In the US, we're not seeing agreement as to what should happen. I said to myself, between 2018 and 2019, America experienced every single possible
natural disaster.
My God, it was terrifying. I'm like, there was hailstorm, there was mudslides, there were floods, there were tornadoes, there were forest fires, there were, I mean, everything could happen. And still, people are saying, it's a fake, it's not real. What is it going to take to have more people believe that, okay, it may not be you personally, but the fact is that there are people in California who really had to move because of forest fires. There are people in New York whose basements were flooded out because of flooding in New York. And so along the coast of North Carolina, South Carolina, Mississippi, all these places that have been ravaged by, you know, climate disaster, weather disaster. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I wish that there was a better way of helping Americans see themselves in the other who is suffering through that goes beyond the 3 seconds or 3 minutes of the news cycle of the day.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think a lot of companies and you know, municipalities, they're looking at resiliency as a solution to kind of prepare and prevent and be prepared for these natural disasters instead of maybe getting it to the root of the core of the issue, which is the climate change issues that we really have. It's like if we could reduce these disasters from, you know, happening with, you know, reduction of carbon and temperature, and I think we wouldn't see all these crazy, you know, natural disasters that we'd have to, you know, have such a resilient planning in place to protect us.
I think that most scientists would say you're not going to turn back anything. What we want to do is slow down or stop the increase, which is a different thing. So if we really have this carbon sink in the system, it's going to have to play out. I like to think sometime of Mother Nature, and this is the reason why I have the book cover with, you know, the Earth on it, the Mother Nature on it, is because I wanted to talk about her as being, okay, I'm tired of you all. I'm going to kick you off.
We're going to reset this whole thing and we're going to redo it if you don't change your ways.
Yeah, let's keep, you know, that arc mythology, the Noah mythology, right? That the flood mythology is in more than one myth. So yes, it's in the Judeo-Christian mythology, but it's also in, you know, in other mythologies as well. So there obviously is some truth to it that, you know, there was some kind of a...
I'm a believer in the flood. I believe it happened.
Right. So I this is an aside. So I did a sermon once on that, right? So I did a sermon on the woman in the Bible. So I was, the topic I was given was the Bible, the woman in the Bible and society, woman in the world. So I'm like, well, I have to talk about, you know, environmental movement. That's major. That's a major thing I want to do. So I couldn't find a woman in the Bible who were in environment movement. But I said, wait a minute. We had an environmental disaster in Noah's Ark.
Yeah, his wife.
But nobody mentioned Noah's wife by name. So I went hunting down all kind of old Jewish texts, and I found a name for her in one of these obscure books. So I go, it was an Episcopalian church I was preaching in. So I went and I said, and I know y'all don't talk about it, but let me just tell you, forget the name, I don't remember it by heart, but let's say her name was Monica. Monica, that's Noah's wife, was the one who had to, you know, find the food for all these animals they were putting in. The people fell out because they never expected that. I think that a good one is laughing at this because I kind of painted this picture of her trying to say, like, Noah, so you want to do what? I have to do what? Right? But the point is that, you know, we have to think about, yes, the resilient design, and the book, The Orange Smart Future, stands for resilience, that is robust in the engineering sense. So you're designing for your worst case, and your worst case more than one time, right? And you're designing for the wild card that they say will probably never happen in 100 years because you believe that more than likely it is going to happen and you want to make sure that you are taking account of it. So this is this idea of resilient planning. I would like to see communities really, if I had a dream that I could fulfill, I would like to see, some of these NGOs like Pew Charitable Trust and Annie Casey Foundation really not just fund the big, environmental NGOs, but fund communities, especially those that have gone through something, to do sort of a Smart Futures community circle, to talk about what they learned from the process, to be given some skills around designing solutions in which they could partner with the local university or the local, two-year college or whatever. Yeah. And have these communities come together to design solutions for themselves.
Did you know E-Tank is the only environmental rental equipment company in the industry that offers a 100% certified clean guarantee at no additional cost? Well, this gives customers the peace of mind knowing that container contents from the previous renter isn't going to cross-contaminate the contents of the current customer and potentially cause liability concerns. You know, E-Tank also provides a one-of-a-kind complete maintenance program for all its rental items, including liquid-tight roll-off containers, fluid transfer pumps, and filtration system components. To learn more about the types of containers and pumps E-Tank supplies, check out their website at www.etank.net. So the next time you are faced with an environmentally challenging project, give E-Tank a call to help solve your problem. It's just that easy.
But how do you think we make the paradigm shift to make all these changes that we need to for, a smart future?
To make a paradigm shift for this future we want, I think the design process, getting into the mindset of these design questions, and this is why I try to make it very, very simple, because you want to have something that's portable. You want to have something that works across the fault lines of, this sector, this industry, this academic field, right? And so the idea of the Smart Futures Framework, which says, okay, here's the five questions you want to ask. Is this product, process, policy, plan, program contributing to a sustainable system, right? Is are we using meaningful and metrics which have some morality attached to them? Are we accounting for all the agents in the system we have under study or to design? And are we designing with their anticipation and their aspiration in mind? And are we designing it so that they have be able to be adaptable in that framework? Because if they're not able to adapt, then they're going to resist. And then everything will fall down. The R is about the resilience, and the T is about transformative use of technology. And so my hope is that if we're able to get, some funding through, and the book is we're looking to see, can we get support to work with cities that already are talking about the SDGs or communities who know they have a problem but don't know where to start, where we could create these circles of change with, as I said, working with the local colleges, local NGOs. And basically, it's something they can almost teach themselves. It's not like it's brain science or rocket science. You don't need a degree in anything to use these five questions. What you need to be able to do is bring enough people to the table that have opposing viewpoints so that your design takes into consideration those opposing viewpoints from day one. Because if you try to design around those people, it will not work.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's true. I got you. I mean, I agree.
And I should say that I come to this theory of change because I once read a paper that was put out by some scientists at Rensselaer, and they had done a study, and they said that a paradigm change happens when 11% of a population community believe that this new idea is the right idea. Mm-hmm. And I started doing the math and said, wait a minute, so are you telling me for real, 11% of a community on the study, so if it's people in Maryland or people in a state of Ohio or whatever, said, no, we really want to move all these things. If I can get 11% of them to agree, we may be able to change the narrative and therefore change the trajectory of the future. And that's where the light bulb went off. So I think because we walk around with a smartphone in our hands, why pick a new idea or a new, you know, word that people have to learn? Everybody uses the word smart almost every single day. All they have to say is, do I want to be smart about my future? If I want to be smart about my future, then I need to ask these questions. I probably need to have something called the Smart Futures app. I didn't think about it. It's a good idea. I think I probably work on that. Working and say Smart Futures app, download to ask smart questions for your smart future. That's it. You
know? Right. Well, I mean, that's good. And you're right. We need to make decisions with a green lens or a green sustainable perspective in all aspects of, you know, our life in some form or fashion. And I know that you, in the book, you talk about not everyone's going to be the evangelist, you know, like yourself, or not everyone's going to be, you know, have a platform like, you know, the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we can shine a light on these types of topics. But there's going to be a lot of people who can just be part of the movement, you know, like everyone doesn't need to be a leader, right? To actually make this change, right? So talk about what you think that looks like.
There's what I call movementology, right? It's because everybody, you know, people like to start things because they get a high from starting something. And half the time we can't sustain it, right? Ask me about this because I know. I don't sleep really nice because I'm like, why did I start this again? But I can't stop because I don't want to look foolish, right? Yeah. But I think if we recognize that, number one, you don't have to be a leader of the movement. You're equally important as a follower, as a worker, as a supporter. And if you, and even in the leader of your own household, the leader of your own life, the way you show up to a meeting, the way you speak up when you see something is wrong. You don't have to be in a movement to speak up in a meeting to say, hey, maybe in my office we should, you know, change from using styrofoam cups to biodegradable paper cups, for example. It might cost you a little bit more, and maybe people have to put a little bit more in pity to buy cups, or maybe everybody should just bring their own cup from
bring home. Your own cup and reuse it, right? You know,
and reuse it. So I'm saying, speak up. And the book asks people to find the space where they're most comfortable and just step out in faith to understand that if we can see ourselves, each of us, as a transformational agent, we ourselves are contributing to the problem. So we ourselves can contribute to the change in whatever ways we can. And that's what I am trying to do, because now I do recycle. I mean, I'm very conscientious about recycling. I have four different, you know, containers in my kitchen that I drop things in. So it's easier to just take one paper bag and put in the blue box and want to put in the, you know, the other box for buckles and all that stuff. And it took me time to find a nice, cute container so my kitchen wouldn't look junky, but I found
that. Those are important things.
Because for some of us, our senses have to be, you know, in tune with these things. So, you know, I'm going to put a blue bin in my bag, right? So find a nice basket or bin that is pretty to you, and you put it in there, and then you just move it when it's time to go into the blue bin. So find a place where you can enter and ask, how and when and where can I enter? I have this concern. I have this fear that my children or my grandchildren, if you don't have any children of your own, there's this idea in Native American philosophy is that we want to be good ancestors, right? We want to be seen as when we pass on, and I might add that many people in the transhumanist movement don't really want to pass on too soon, but when they want to live until 150 and 200 years. But if we allow ourselves to pass on after, let's say, 100 years is a good enough time to live, we pass on and leave something behind, we'll be seen as good ancestors. So Miss Sundberg and her crew don't have to come thundering at us like, you guys are the pits, you know, you have messed up the world for us.
Yeah. There's a lot of millennials right now and Gen Zs that are really concerned about the status of the planet. And you know, their population, their population percentage in the world today is increasing, you know, day by day. It's you know, it's what, 30-40% of the country of the world now population is in that millennial or Gen Z zone. they're going to have a major voice and what things, how we do, you know, and make policy changes in society. So they're.
Well, I hope, and I say I hope because unfortunately, I think COVID may have slowed down some of those movements because they couldn't gather anymore. And for countries where they like to repress people, right, they have been using that to repress these movements. So we have to, again, those of us who have a little more freedom to move and freedom to organize, have to find ways of supporting these young people who are carrying the torch for us. You know, so the Sean Grays of this world, the Clarence of this world, we have to find these young people who we can mentor and support. Yeah. Started their own podcast. Okay, can we be on their podcast? Can they be on our podcast? Can we exchange?
That's right.
So we can move forward because, quite frankly, they have the energy to go. We're more like, oh gosh, it's 2 o'clock. I've got to go to my bed.
We wear out a little earlier than them at this stage in our life.
Well, unfortunately, I'm still going to bed at 2 o'clock. I'm trying to get to 12 o'clock. That's my goal.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay. So for the listeners, Claire, how do they get your book? How do we get your book?
Well, the book is on Amazon, Smart Futures for a Flourishing World. As I said, it's part of a series, Resetting Our Futures. You heard about the stories. I just want to say a little bit more about that. So what I did was in futures thinking, we have this idea of describing the world in layers. And that the world begins with the base of the mythology that drives us, right? We all are born into a particular mythological system, whether it's based on Hindu philosophy, Christian philosophy, whatever. But that philosophy still is a part of a global mythology. So I did something quite crazy. I decided to have think of COVID as an opportunity that the gods that created us, there are many creator gods in many cultures. So I had the creator gods of many cultures, if not all cultures, come together in a convocation to start the book. And I say, they've come together to say, basically, we're going to put a pause on these humans. They're getting on really crazy down there. And so I actually, you know, kind of, I didn't plan on doing it when I started writing the book. This came after I started the book, when I realized that I didn't have that causality that helped me to make sense of why I thought the COVIDemic period was such an important transition for humanity, because it was like a wake-up call to so many people, that we had to move faster, we had to work harder, we had to work differently, we had to form new alliances, new partnerships. And so the beauty of COVID for me, and so the book starts with this and it ends with the story as well, and we talk about Anansi as the storyteller, which has traversed from Africa to the Caribbean and to the Americas, Anansi being the collector of these stories of hope. And I start at the year 3000 and I end in the year 2030, because 2030 is where we have all agreed that we're saying we want the world to look like this. And therefore, I figure since we at least have some agreement, let me end with that as the nearest future to which we might aspire. And 3000 I picked because I wanted something outside of our lifespan. But again, recognizing that our mythology, the stories that will be told of us, could either be like, well, back in the 21st century, when humanity was still pretty young, you know, they had a major plague. It was called the COVID pandemic. And in that time, there were lots of wars and petty fights about this, and they weren't getting along. But some people woke up and found a way to patch up their quarrels enough that they could save themselves from self-extinction. That's kind of what I want the story to be. I don't want in year 4000 to hear, you know, humans are walking around and we're going to see something like the Matrix wearing some tube somewhere.
Virtual world, right? We don't want that. We want a real world, not a virtual world.
Right. But nobody has written a movie to counteract the effects of the Matrix. So I believe the power of story is so much that we're hurtling closer to Matrix than we are towards the Star Trek fantasy.
Yeah.
As a Trekkie, I would like us to move towards the Star Trek fantasy. So I have 3000 where we are now a star-going species. We have human outposts on the world, and we have actually come to achieve peace on earth and goodwill to all humans.
Well, that's a good story, and I'm gonna leave it there with the listeners today. This has been a fantastic interview. It's been exciting. The book is really good, and I spent a lot of time reading the book, and the storytelling that came with it really added to the importance of understanding, hey, that we're in a fight for our lives in a sense here. We need to get this thing right. We want to leave a better world behind for our future and our generation. So, Claire, thanks for coming on the show today. It was great. And we're going to promote the book. We'll get it out there. I've got links on the website for everybody to get it to buy it. And thanks for coming on the show today.
And thanks for having me. I truly enjoyed you stretching my imagination.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.
I want to thank our guest, Dr. Claire Nelson, for coming onto the show today. If you want to learn more about Claire and to get a copy of her new book, Smart Futures for a Flourishing World, A Paradigm Shift for Achieving Global Sustainability, you can go to www.resettingourfuture.com. That's www.resettingourfuture.com. You can also connect with her via LinkedIn, and I'll put a link to her contact information on my website. To listen to future environmental transformation podcasts, you can check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other podcast networks, or better yet, from my website at www.seankgrady.com. You can also follow me on Instagram or the Environmental Transformation Podcast Facebook page. If you enjoyed the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends. We'd also love to hear feedback from the ET Nation about the episode and any future podcast topics you'd like me to cover. Well, thanks for listening, and until next time, make a positive impact in someone's life today.